session number 10093, Reel 3.
Vice Marshal Bird Wilson, Reel 3.
It is a dangerous position to be in on the inner side of the circle because a ME-110 that wasn't actually that you were not attacking could easily turn in from the circle and get on your tail. So the answer was really to get in quickly and then get out of it as quick as you could. But Manfred Chanin believed in this theory, and I think he was very successful in carrying out the operation with his flight of fighters.
Didn't he feel any divided loyalties, being an Austrian?
No. He rather hated the Germans. And this was a thing, I think, made him into such a fine fighter pilot. Likewise, after he'd been a fighter pilot, he joined the SOE and was dropped into northern Italy once or twice. And although he got a DFC out of the Royal Air Force, he got an MC and a DSO for being on the SOE operations in northern Italy. There is a very fine book written about Chanin called Double Mission by Norman Franks.
How much warning would you have of one of these Luftwaffe packs coming across?
Being at Debden, we're inland. Debden, sorry, is near Saffron Waldron in Essex. And we would have a fair amount of warning, but it all depended how the controllers wanted to use squadrons who were situated, whether they be situated on the right on the coastline of England or back, as we were at Debden. The squadrons were fed in gradually in numbers. They weren't all scrambled together. I don't think Air Marshal Keith Park wanted to have all his aircraft in the air at the same time, because the Germans could well have been using the raids as a fake and then bringing in the main raid later. So he always kept some squadrons down, and sometimes we were scrambled late and it is impossible for us to get to grips with the Germans. Sometimes we were scrambled ideally and intercepted them as they came over the coast, say, around Harwich or something like that. And that is ideal. And we went straight in at the bombers before the fighters could get down at us.
How would you actually launch an attack on a bomber? What would be the favoured approach?
But it all depends on the formation that is coming in. We are usually fed in from the side at more or less the same level, as I said, not above the bomber. Except on one occasion, we did intercept a German bomber and bombers, and one of the bombers broke away as though it is on a reconnaissance by itself and heading for sort of Ipswich area. We intercepted it at Chelmsford, and it is a Dornier, I remember, and I was leading a section at about 16,000 feet, and it is all on its own with no fighter escort, and we just went in and carried out a stern attack, setting it on fire, and then the crew of three bailed out, and down went the Dornier, near the reservoir, near Colchester. It's very hard to define exactly which way one would go in to attack a large formation. One has to judge it on the spot and take the more or less the first ones that come your way. If you can break up the leaders, that is the ideal situation, because you knew that they were the pathfinders for the bombing raid. So if you take out the leaders, that is fine.
What did you think to the tactics that the Germans were adopting in adopting these formations?
The bomber formations are very good. They bombed on their leader's bombing, really. The leader dropped his bombs and followed by everybody else thereafter. The fighter formations, they were there, but we didn't really see what sort of formations they were in, but they used to come hurling down at us and through us and then up again. They used, the tactics came to be named yo-yo tactics. They'd be above us and they'd come down and then bounce back again to the altitude and then down again. And this is what they called yo-yo, but that was later in the conflict. But they'd learned their tactics, as I said, say once again, in the Spanish War. And they were very flexible in their formations. I think the Germans did a very good job in protecting their fighters, protecting their bombers. But we likewise managed to get in through to their bombers, and we took on the bombers, and the Spitfires were meant to protect our tails. But likewise, we as Hurricane pilots were worried about Spitfires as well. Having experience, you know, them shooting down Hurricanes in the past, we were had that in the back of our memory the whole time. But it's only a matter of seconds to identify an aircraft, whether to shoot or not to shoot. I recall intercepting a raid coming in, and a Spitfire an aircraft came down right in front of me, and I was just about to press the trigger, and within a second or two, and then I suddenly realized it was a diving Spitfire heading for its base, and he's a very lucky chap. And I'm very lucky as well, because that's the last thing I'd like to do, is shoot down one of my own aircraft. But it's hard to imagine that a chap, you only have a second, a click, or click-click, of life to make up your mind whether you shoot or you don't shoot. And you put hundreds of rounds of ammunition into an aircraft which you cannot miss, or couldn't miss. And it must have happened once or twice, when a chap has shot down a friendly aircraft. And likewise, we know and have read stories of the Germans shooting down their own chaps.
Presumably, the more fearful you were, the more likely you were to shoot first and ask questions afterwards.
When you say fearful, how do you mean fearful?
Well, someone who was particularly edgy.
Yes, that could be the case, but nevertheless, I think the lessons that one learns, that identify before pressing your button is firing button is a lesson which I think most of us learned.
So most of your activity, air activity in the Battle of Britain, actually took place over Essex, did it?
Most of it took place over Essex and down to London, and then at one particular time, the latter part of August, we were moved down to Tangmere on the south coast to relieve 601 Squadron, City of London Squadron, which had been experienced quite a few casualties, and They had been bombed at Tangmere, and they were sent up to Debden to have a bit of a rest, but somehow they got bombed at Debden as well, so they didn't get much of a rest. But we spent quite a few days down at Tangmere and had quite a few successes of intercepting the raids that were coming in from Cherbourg. One of the better interceptions we did, we shot down a JU-88, which force landed ultimately on the tip of Selsey Bill. And we went out and collected the tailplane from this aircraft and a gun, souvenirs for the squadron. And I tried to go and see the pilot in Chichester prison, police station, I think it was. And I was confronted by some silly flying officer, intelligence officer, who wouldn't permit me to see the German pilot. I wanted a personal souvenir of his gun, but I wasn't allowed to have it.
What do you think would have been your personal relations with him if...
Oh, no. It had been quite okay. We in the RAF didn't really have bitterness against the Germans. Not like the Poles. They had hatred in their hearts, and some of the Czechs had hatred. And that's a way to fight the war. We would have been much more successful, I think, in our claims, and shooting down of German bombers, etc., if we had have had real hatred in our hearts. It takes a lot of things to stir up the British, and this is what was most noticeable. I wouldn't have liked to have been a German against a Polish hurricane squadron.
Did you come across East Europeans at this particular time?
Yes, we had one or two posted to our squadrons. Best of RAF squadrons, you have a mongrel outfit. You have Englishmen, you have Scots, Welsh, you know, and you have Poles and Czechs and things. And later in the war, I had a wing of Spitfires, and I had all sorts of nationalities, including a squadron of Czechs under command, South Africans, Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians, you name them, I seem to have got them, and it made a very fine, aggressive outfit, and we did some powerful work.
Was there such a thing as national techniques peculiar to one particular nationality?
No. The Poles, I think, I'd credit the Poles with the sheer determination to get in at the Hun, and not to worry about the finesse of fighter command teachings, but go straight bullet at China shop. I think some of the Poles rather lost their lives because of this technique, but at least they had a great success. We were much more polite and standoffish, you know. But likewise, some of our chaps had a very aggressive attitude.
Turning on to the performance of the Hurricane in relation to the German fighters, was there any particular German fighter that was most feared?
No, there's no actual fighter that we feared. We felt that the ME-109 was slightly superior in speed and dive. We were happy in a turning circle. We would have taken him on quite well in a turning circle. 110s, ME-110s, we weren't terribly worried about, except make sure you didn't get in front of it, because it had a fairly good armament. And the bombers we'd take on anyway. Just they had one gun against our 8 guns.
Were Are there any particular incidents which stick out in your mind that happened to you personally in the Battle of Britain that you'd like to recount?
Only two, really, I'd say. On this 15th of September, the squadron was scrambled from Debden, and we headed down towards the south of London, and we saw the raid coming in, and it was above us, and we were flying, I suppose, about 15,000-16,000 feet. And one hears of people getting anoxia, and this is what happened to me. I got anoxia, and I felt terrible, and something had gone wrong with my oxygen system. And I got down, I started diving down, and I found myself over the English Channel. And there was a German aircraft, right down on the water, just by the water, flying as hard as he could back to France. I did two or three attacks on him as the French coast came up, and I didn't actually shoot him down, but I severely damaged him, and then I thought it was about time I got back, and so I turned around, and I felt so ill that I had to land at Southend, I think it was, and they looked at my oxygen. They found something wrong with my oxygen connections, and it does affect one's balance and physical well-being when you get anoxia. And there was nothing worrying about it, you know, frightened about it. I just felt very ill.
A kind of giddiness.
As though you're coming unconscious. And this is just a personal experience that happened to me on the 15th of September. Thereafter, you know, I'm perfectly okay. And went up and, you know, intercepted bombers thereafter. Now, the second thing was being shot down, I suppose, is the most exciting thing I happened. We were scrambled on the... in September, scrambled to go off to the east of the Thames, and we saw the bombers ahead of us. We had scrambled a bit late, and we were about 15 or 16,000 feet chasing the bombers, really. And suddenly, when we were in the sort of south of the Thames area, Spitfires came diving down through our formation, and we thought, oh God, so we were a bit worried about that, but we didn't realize that they were being chased by 109s. And the next thing I experienced was a terrific bang in the cockpit, and flames coming up from my fuel tank, and I looked up and I found I hadn't got any perspex left in my hood, and it was getting fairly hot, so I decided I'd better get out. So I bailed out immediately, and one noticed the quietness of having bailed out. The battle was going on. You could hear the rat-a-tat-tat of guns going off in the distance, and also the noise of engines of fellow pilots of the squadron circling round to make sure one got down safely. And I was slightly wounded with shrapnel and stuff, and as I floated down, as I said, it was very peaceful, and then I looked down and I saw a naval torpedo boat coming out to intercept me in the mouth of the Thames, and this they did. And oh yes, I took off my helmet and dropped it, and that leather helmet, and that went down faster than I did. And then I splashed down in the water, and the naval chaps gave me a shot of rum, I remember, which I didn't drink in those days, and a shot of morphine, which I suppose I appreciated, or didn't appreciate at the time, but it relieved the slight burns I'd received from my fuel tank. They rushed me back to Chatham Naval Hospital, and then from there I was moved the next day down to Hayward's Heath. And it is 42 years after the event, in 1982, that I read in a book that I was the 40th victory of Major Adolf Galland, who was a famous fighter, German fighter ace. And he became a lieutenant general of the Luftwaffe. I wrote to him and congratulated him on receiving his Knight of the Iron Cross for his 40th victory, which I happened to be the sucker who was shot down. And he wrote back with his story, and my story tallied very accurately with his. And although he came across for Sir Douglas Bader's memorial service, he phoned me, and we tried to make arrangements for a lunch date, but we failed to do so, and I've never seen him or heard from him since. But I would likewise one day hope I will meet him, and I can assure you there's no ill feeling against him.
Whilst the Battle of Britain was going on, were you aware that you and your brother officers were making history?
No. We were extremely badly briefed on what was happening and what would be the consequence of our fighting. We were young, as I said before. Most of us were only young, in a range of 20, 23, that sort of age. And we were just carrying out our orders, really. We didn't look ahead. We didn't know that the invasion of England really was about to take place. And the intelligence briefing was not very good in those days by our station commanders or our squadron commanders. In fact, I don't think they knew, really. We were just up and down. And as I say, even in France, we didn't know what the devil was going on. We just were retreating the whole time. And in England, we knew something big was taking place, and we were just there to fight them. And if the Germans had have invaded, then I'm sure it would be the first time that we would have been called upon to strafe them on the beaches and in their boats, and we would willingly have done it. But our casualties would have been very high.
Do you think it would have made much difference to you if you had known the historical significance of it all?
No, it might have helped with a bit of more hatred. I would, with hindsight, would like to have had a bit more hatred for the Germans, against the Germans.
So did the public at large seem to know what the significance of it all was?
We're a funny race in England, you know. We take things as they come. They bomb us and bombed us and stuff. We accepted it all. We didn't really know what was happening. We didn't really get excited about these things. We're very peculiar people. We just take everything in our stride and, I suppose, criticise each other, really, for not having done such a thing.
How did the strain of it all in the Battle of Britain compare with in France?
In the Battle of Britain, we had jolly good radar controllers, and you scrambled, and you were in their hands and you knew what they were telling you over the radio was accurate. In the Battle of France, you didn't have anything like that. You were flying on your wits and your eyeballs. And if you saw a German, you were jolly lucky. But as I said, there was no intelligence. You didn't know really what the Germans were up to, except when you looked down and saw the refugees and you saw a German in the air. And then you got into the fight.
You were talking earlier on about the question of fear. Was there anything you could do to control fear at all?
No, there was nothing. It's a man's makeup. Whether he's a brave chap or not a brave chap, whether he worries or he doesn't worry. And there's very few people who can advise another man on worry. It's a human makeup. But you did see people, particularly later when I went on rest after being shot down. I went on rest to an operational training unit at Sutton Bridge or Aston Down, and then Aston Down. And you saw chaps who had really taken shock extremely badly. They'd come in the bar and they'd have a terrible facial twitch or a body twitch, and there was nothing you could do to help them except to act back again the same twitch. If they had a facial twitch while you're drinking your drink, whatever it might be, you did the same thing back to them, and so they realized that they were doing it. It's a very cruel way to be kind. And I can remember at Aston Down seeing these people with twitch, as we called it, and he cured chaps in the end. It really did. But likewise, and they returned to operations thereafter.
Would it be possible for somebody to go up, say, during the Battle of Britain, and deliberately try to avoid the enemy?
Yes, I'm sure there were cases. And I don't know particularly of one, but I'm sure there are cases of people being scrambled and they had engine trouble, or they had radio trouble, or they had oxygen trouble, or they had everything. The aircraft was never right. Now, after two or three of those, then an alert squadron commander or a flight commander would either call that chap aside and say, look, you're not made for this game. You know, you better get posted out. Later in the war, when I had a Spitfire wing, I had cases of chaps coming up to me and saying, I can't take it. And these were chaps who hadn't been with us very long, you know. And I said, how many missions have you done? Escorts have you done? And they say either none or one or two. I said, right, you're going to do one more and then I will post you. I will have you posted. And you'd put him as your number two and you'd watch him the whole time. But I made sure that he did one mission.
Why was that?
For his own mind and his own human being part of himself. If I had just said, this is about 1943, if I had said, all right, you can go off on rest, he would never be a man again.
A question of his self-respect.
Yes, yeah. But he'd be tucked into my squadron, or my wing, and we'd get him there, and get him back, and get him away. There was an awful place called